You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to The Brian Callen Show. Once again, sans Brian Callen. You know, we briefly had the actual star of the show on the show, but, you know, this is now like we're in one of the later seasons where we can't really afford the star's high price. And so he's more of a guest star now than an actual recurring, which is a pity because today's guest is, as usual, fantastic. We have Jamie Holmes on the line, who has written a book called Nonsense, The Power of Not Knowing. This was recommended to me by a listener. I could search through my Twitter account and find it and should and give the person their due credit. But whoever you are, if you're out there, you know that this was your great idea. So, Jamie, why did you decide to write a book about nonsense?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Hunter. I had been researching mental conflicts. I did a piece that was in the New Republic a few years ago, 4 years ago, that was about how people deal with, it was about the psychology of willpower, but more generally, it was about how people deal with conflict. So I want the cookie, I don't want the cookie, I want the cigarette, I don't want the cigarette, and also trade-off decisions like I only have a certain amount of money, I need to buy medicine, I need to buy this other thing. So, and what were the effects of considering mental conflicts? And that led me to a book by this social psychologist at the University of Maryland named R.E.A. Kruglansky called The Psychology of Closed-Mindedness. And it was just this very rich research thread on a concept called the need for closure. And that's our need for definite answers, any answer, as opposed to confusion and ambiguity. So that was the start of it.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, you know, this book actually, I mean, as I was reading it, you know, at first I was like, oh, nonsense. Like so many of these books, you read them and you're like, Jamie, did you just do a really intense fart?
That's the heating system in my Chelsea apartment in New York.
So occasionally that's going to happen. Okay. Well, now we know. I mean, listen, just want to make sure that you're not just flatulating your way through this whole thing.
I can turn it off. Give me a second.
Okay.
Should I?
No, how often is it going to do that?
Probably not that often.
Okay. So we'll just enjoy it when it comes in. But yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, you know, there's like, so we had Mark Kurlansky on the podcast, you know, and he sort of really, it seems like, pioneered this whole microhistory thing where we, you know, pick one aspect of the world and then just look at it intensely and from all these different perspectives. And so there's a whole lot of books that are out there like that. And I have to say, coming in, when I heard nonsense, I was like, oh, this is going to be an intriguing look at nonsense. But what I didn't realize is just the raw power of the book in terms of understanding that need for closure, which is, I mean, just probably, I mean, one of the more timely books in terms of what's going on in U.S. presidential politics right now. I mean, it's kind of staggering how relevant this book is.
Thank you very much, Hunter. No, I certainly didn't realize there is a good sections of the book which talk about extremism.
Mm-hmm.
I like the fact that you know, the opening quote is which I ironically quote John Wayne, where he says, I don't trust ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, you know, Donald Trump was recently endorsed by John Wayne's daughter, I think, or something like that, which I thought was hilarious. But you're right. In fact, the recent times that I've spoken about the book, I've focused a lot on politics and people have asked about it.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the interesting thing is that, you know, because a lot of the books that you're talking about, I mean, you know, that's a lot of the sort of people that we have on here. And, you know, there is this interesting set of tensions in the mind, right? Like, you know, we can look at things from a big picture perspective or a little picture perspective. We can be optimistic or we can be pessimistic. And there is a tendency to think that one is good or one is bad, right? And the point is not that, you know, the desire, I mean, I know that, you know, if you're a liberal, then your mind will go racing and you'll be like, oh, the need for closure is bad, right? And because you'll see it very clearly in conservatives. And if you're a conservative, you know, your mind will go racing in a different direction and be like, yeah, that's political correctness. That's what he's talking about. These guys won't even have a conversation about culture or anything like that.
Right.
So It sort of reminds me of, you know, the old Serenity Prayer, right? You know, teach me the wisdom to know the things I can't change, or, you know, I can't remember, now I'm screwing it up, but the point is, there are things you can change, there are things you can't change, but wisdom lies in knowing the difference. And so there's a real danger either way to having closure or not having closure.
That's right. So this is, you know, this is why Kruglensky emphasizes that we need the need for closure. And most of the time, this works perfectly well. We have to be reducing complexity. We have to be able to act when there's a fork in the road. There has to be something that makes mental conflicts, especially when we need to act, unpleasant. Mm-hmm. And there has to be, you know, we have to have a way of managing complexity. The psychologist Jordan Peterson has a great line where he says, the need to manage complexity looms above all other psychological concerns. There is a thread within this research which tries to make it political, one side on the spectrum and the other, and that's a researcher named John Jost. And he's done a lot of work saying, oh, look, you know, look how closely tied this is to authoritarianism, look how closely tied this is to the right wing. I didn't emphasize that research so much for a few reasons. But one is your point, which is that this obviously affects both sides of the spectrum.
Right.
There's obviously just as much rigidity in some aspects of, you know, you have extremes on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And I put this to Kruglensky, and this is a point of Travis Prue's, one of the researchers I focus on in the book. And he says, it really paint yourself into a corner into saying that this is just a right wing ideology. And Kruglensky's way of reconciling this, because he's worked with Jost, is to say, look, if you were in a town which had half liberals and half conservatives, you had a high need for closure, you would be more likely to gravitate towards the conservative ideology because it has, kind of by content, more rigidity and slightly more kind of need for certainty within it.
But I think I think that conservatives would definitely point to political correctness. There are certain conversations that liberals really don't want to have. They don't like to talk about the genetic role of, you know, the role genetics plays in intelligence. And they don't like to talk about, you know, groups having characteristics, right? Like liberals are, you know, very comfortable talking about like unique individuals and all of that sort of stuff. And they're very comfortable talking about like all people have values, right? So they're willing to like zoom all the way out and zoom all the way down. But that middle level, when we start talking about, you know, do Russians have a national character? Do Americans have a national character? They just get incredibly nervous and can't do that. And they refuse to have those conversations. So, I mean, I honestly think, I mean, you know, is it more one or is it the other? No, but I think the other thing that has to be recognized and what part of what comes through in your book is, you know, there's also a real price to openness, right? Like, and this is a real danger that I have seen in science because, you know, my experience was I was working with kids and would hear them say things like, oh, I didn't get the math gene or I didn't get a natural ear for languages. And there's a huge amount of science that says those beliefs are incredibly destructive and not particularly helpful. But what happens is that science has such a culture of open investigation and wanting to figure things out that they never close the book on a lot of these questions. They're not willing to say, you know what, that's bad. Like, you shouldn't do that.
Mm. I might disagree with you a little bit on that. Although, to your previous point, I think there is a good amount of authoritarianism in political correctness, mm-hmm. and pushing for that, especially nowadays, and microaggressions and kind of policing what I'm going to experience in the world, which is slightly unrealistic. But in terms of science, I would argue that there's a fair amount of authoritarianism in various areas of science.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Yeah. But I mean, I think that's the thing is that, in that wisdom of knowing the difference, right? You know, there's closure in the wrong places and then, you know, a sort of open-mindedness in the wrong places too. Like, you need to make a decision at a certain point and act on it. And like, having everything open to investigation can be really problematic. Like, it's taken a long time for science, for example, to start to, you know, even address you know, a lot of the wackier theories that float around about, like, for example, there's been this huge problem with the Zika virus, right? And, you know, there's all these conspiracy theories floating around about it actually being Monsanto and being some sort of pesticide. And, you know, science now, I mean, you know, the Brazilian government is having to, A, try and combat the disease, but B, also try and combat the conspiracy theories. But, you know, that's something that science has only really sort of developed in the last 20, 30 years. In general, you know, scientists have a tendency to be sort of meek and mild and be like, well, you know, I mean, there is some element of doubt.
Those are the scientists I really like.
I agree. I agree. But the thing is that, you know, again, you have to find the balance, right? Like,
well, right. And it's not binary.
You know,
they'll say that for close calls, you know, or, you know, it's also in certain cases, you'll have researchers who want to emphasize the uncertainty on certain issues. You know, for example, let's say the environment, you know, there's a reason to emphasize scientific uncertainty there among some quarters. so there, you know, there's a Feynman quote. I think it's Feynman who says, you know, I'm not 100% sure of anything, but I have degrees of uncertainty. So there are a lot of things that we do know with great certainty, even though that, you know, even though there's a little doubt in there, it doesn't mean that. So this is about the preponderance of evidence, not just, you know.
Yeah, totally. And but I think that's the interesting thing is that because I mean, just to your point, we had Naomi Oreskes and crap, why am I blanking on his name?
Right, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but they, you know, they wrote that book, Merchants of Doubt.
Yeah.
Which is all about how, you know, essentially, you know, science can easily be misused to create a sense of non-closure. Eric Conway. And so, you know, so that, you know, nothing actually gets resolved or nothing gets done. And, you know, we stand at the edge of one history, which is the history of smoking. And so we're all pretty comfortable recognizing the fact that, yeah, you know, the tobacco companies, you know, misrepresented the science deliberately as a way to, you know, get people to keep smoking, because as long as you aren't sure that smoking is bad, you keep doing it and you keep buying cigarettes.
Exactly.
But, you know, there are other issues where, you know, there is a lot of, like, is the book closed? Is the book not closed? And at any point, the book can be reopened. But the point is that, yeah, again, we have to, like, you know, at a certain point, we have to make the decision, you know what, like, that's closed. Like, I've made my mind up about that, and I'm going to act on that.
Right. And, you know, a lot of this plays out in terms of, you know, what are your standards of evidence? You know, what kind of evidence do you accept and what don't you? And there are various theoretical positions which take harder or softer lines on that. And those are really interesting debates.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the interesting thing, too, because, I mean, one of the things that has happened, really, in terms of science is that, you know, science is now realizing that it made a systematic error for the last 40 years, which was to discount the role of emotions and beliefs and all of that sort of stuff. And so, you know, you have in the 60s, you have these crazy models, you know, what behavioral economists call homo economicus, right? Rational agent theory, the idea that like humans are purely rational. And then you have Skinner and, you know, B.F. Skinner comes along and says, everything is stimulus response. Like there is no such thing as the mind, like belief doesn't exist. And so science, you know, went down that tangent, which I think was a systematic bias that came out of the love of reason and you know, feeling like beliefs and emotions were disgusting and the large historical problem.
Right. Yeah, did you actually, I went to this museum in D.C. One of the Smithsonian, just as an aside, one of the Smithsonian museums in D.C. actually has a rocket that B.F. Skinner designed. Do you know about this?
No.
So he got a government grant to design, like, you know, how to guide a rocket. And, you know, he had this obsession with pigeons. So he thought that, I've seen the rocket. It's in the museum. And there's three little holes where you're supposed to put pigeons in. And there's a little diagram. And you would, like, drill a hole through. I'm not kidding. You would drill a hole through the pigeon's head. And the pigeon would peck on a screen. And therefore, it would guide the pigeon.
Wow. But that's
I think this is the second most cited psychologist, you know, of that century.
Yeah.
After Freud. So it tells you a lot about where we were.
Well, and also, I mean, you know, so funnily enough, have you read Gravity's Rainbow?
I have not.
So that's funny because I didn't realize that, but like in Gravity's Rainbow, I recall that like there's some of that sort of stuff in Gravity's Rainbow. And at the time, like, I mean, that's the nature of reading, you know, anything by Thomas Pynchon. You're like, this dude's on a weird tangent, right? As opposed to you realize, oh, he's making pointed social commentary. Right. It's just that, you know, who has read as much as Thomas Pynchon? Probably nobody. But anyway, so yeah, that's really interesting. But yeah, we went down, I mean, you know, this massive, massive rabbit hole. And I think in general, we've all sort of started to realize that, yeah, you know, I mean, scientists are also human and they can make huge mistakes. And I mean, I think that's so much of what's happened between left and right is that science went down this weird tangent where it was like, belief and emotion are bad and disgusting, right? Swung right. too far that way. Yes, belief and emotion can be problematic, but you know, you shouldn't be so disgusted by them that you create models that try and pretend that humans are purely rational. Yeah. And then proceeded to, you know, insult religious people. And, you know, then, you know, we became unable to have a balanced conversation about culture. And right. so now you have these bizarre extreme viewpoints where, you know, we sort of, I mean, that's the real tragedy, right? Is that political correctness was designed to try and correct the excesses of, you know, World War II and the Holocaust. And mm. now it kind of feels like by not talking about culture for the last 40, 50 years, we've reached a point that seems remarkably similar.
Mm, elaborate on that.
Well, in the sense that, right, so if you have, you know, after World War II, right, the liberals are like, oh my God, thinking of ourselves as groups or, you know, any sort of group identity is really, really problematic, right? Mm. So we're going to pretend like groups don't matter, right? Mm. And, you know, Skinner goes down that road and, you know, the economics profession goes down that road. All there is the individual. And because all there is the individual, therefore, you know, all social policy becomes about that, right? It's individuals, and all we have to do is look at inputs and outputs. Are there resources? Are there not resources, right? Group psychology is irrelevant. And then what happens is that, you know, Republicans and, you know, people on the right who are very often people of faith and really believe that beliefs matter, which is a more accurate view of the world, see that that is happening. And, you know, start to try and have conversations about like, well, you know, I see a lot of these kids have a bad attitude, or it seems like African-Americans have an attitude that doesn't necessarily serve them in school. It doesn't seem like they appreciate education or whatever. And what starts off as a fairly, you know, said in a more helpful way point of view, well, you know, then they're told, oh, you're racist. You know, you can't say that, like, everybody's equally good and all of that sort of stuff. And so then the viewpoints become, you know, as the argument heats up, it just becomes more and more extreme and more simplistic until you arrive at the incredibly simplistic conversation that we have today, which is not a conversation, it's a shouting match.
Mm. Yeah, I don't know if I really follow or agree with that. if I agree with that telling of history, but I will say that, you know, I think what was influencing Skinner and, you know, after Skinner was also, this is just the way those people thought of the world. A lot of it was, I really think that the computer analogy had a lot to do with it. They mm-hmm. had this analogy of the human mind that we're like a computer.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have that, you have to discount culture.
Yep.
You have to think it's less important. I'm not sure. I don't know. There's not many Republicans that I, or, you know, and I have friends of Republicans and libertarians who are really deeply willing or, you know, quick to discuss the socioeconomic causes of, you know, in fact, it's the opposite. They don't want to discuss the socioeconomic causes of
I think
poverty.
That's the thing. I think it's a mixed bag, right? They're certainly willing to discuss certain parts of it, right? Mm-hmm. So they're more than willing to talk about personal responsibility, right? And they generally
right.
see that there's a lack of personal responsibility in, you know, the educational system or anything like that. But then on the other side of things, you know, they want to pretend that racism never, you know, either racism never existed, which is clearly delusional, or that, like, the Civil War happened and then racism was no longer a thing. And then, you know, if you really push them, they'll be like, okay, there was a little bit of racism after the Civil War, but then we had the Civil Rights Movement and now there's no racism. So, you know, I think what, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the right to life, right? Like both sides use that creatively in different ways. So, you know, you'll have, you know, vegetarians who are like, you know, all animals are special and anybody who eats meat is murder. But at the same time will be like, you, how dare you infringe on a woman's right to choose? I should be able to, you know, abort as many children as I want. And then you'll have, you know, Republicans who are like, meat is murder. That's crazy. I mean, you know, my mother's family is from Kansas City. And I went back for a cousin's wedding and, you know, loaded up. We had a lot of barbecue. There's a lot of barbecue in Kansas City. And so after, like, you know, a night of barbecue and a morning of barbecue, there was then like a brunch of barbecue. And it was like too much for me. I'd reached my meat limit. And so I walked over to the vegetable platter and loaded the vegetable platter up with as many vegetables as I could. And, you know, my cousin's aunt was like looking at me incredibly suspiciously. She was like, she literally couldn't understand why somebody would have a plate of all vegetables. And, you know, proceeded to say, like, you know, did they turn you vegetarian out there, Hunter?
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I think it's the same thing. You'll find these very bizarre ways in which we use the right to life. You know, Republicans, you know, don't respect the right to life when you're talking about, you know, people who are of other cultures necessarily, right, in terms of terrorists or whatever. Whereas, you know, liberals want to defend that. They're like, yeah, these people are misguided, but they're, you know, also human beings and we should be careful about how much violence we use, right? So it's all the same basic drives. They're just being used to justify very different points of view.
I generally agree with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, I don't know. We had John Haidt on the show.
Yeah.
And I mean, you know, that's the thing. When you look at the base of this, I mean, a lot of it is these sort of moral intuitions, like freedom, you know, and no,
right.
You know, I mean, that's the point. I mean, freedom can be used to justify the freedom. I mean, you know, the Alamo was fought over the freedom to own slaves, right? And then, you right. know.
I mean, right. And what do you mean by freedom? What is yeah. freedom? I wrote a piece a few years ago that was about biometric IDs, mm-hmm. which in the United States, you know, it's like Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the way they've been using them in some developing countries was to give people IDs for the first time. And of course, that gives you access to a lot of state, you know, to a lot of benefits. Like, it was, in fact, the state that gave us last names. And mm-hmm. why did they do that? Well, for taxes, for army, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that, like, is anonymity freedom? Is that your definition of freedom? Like having no interaction with the state? And so where's, you know, where are the roads come from? Where's the, so yeah, there are different definitions of freedom too.
Well, and I mean, that's, again, it's that idea of knowing the difference. Cause I mean, one of the ones that I love, right, is that, you know, so I mean, in general, Greek people do not pay their taxes. Like they believe that it's part of their patriotic duty to tax dodge.
Right.
And that's
Italy too.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, I mean, historically it was because under the Ottoman Empire, you know, if you were a true Greek patriot, then that meant that what you needed to do was not pay your taxes. You should avoid your taxes at all costs. But, you know, when you then reach a stage where it's like, oh, now we're living in, you know, it's our own country and we all dodge our taxes, that's actually not helping Greece or the Greek people. It's hurting them. So, you know, I mean, I think that's the thing. Again, like these cultures form, they form in one context, the context changes, but then the culture doesn't necessarily change to respond to those changed circumstances.
Right. Right. Yeah. And that's one of the things that, you know, I emphasize in the book is that, you know, you have these belief systems, as you point out, which are, you know, kind of picked up from your social world,
mm-hmm.
and you close on those.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's good or bad really depends upon the idea that you're closing on.
Mm-hmm.
Is it generous? Is it judgmental? Is it wise? Is it cruel? And so forth.
Yeah. And does it, I mean, yeah, I mean, does it make sense in the modern world? I mean, the, do you know Richard Nisbett's work?
Yes, of course.
Yeah, so we had Richard on the show a couple of times, and mm-hmm. you know, the whole thing basically about, you know, there's this tension between herders and farmers, right? And the herders have an honor culture. And I mean, so many of the problems in today's world is that people closed on an honor culture, which made sense in a herding context.
Yeah.
And, you know, now it's created all these problems. I mean, the Arabs are a herder culture, you know, a lot of the American South is a herder culture, right? And there's, I mean, I just actually read an article last night by Thomas Sowell, And it was pretty fascinating just about, and it seems like, you know, basically the, his whole contention is that, you know, it's misleading to talk about black people because there are really two very distinct black cultures in America. There are those people who had the American slave experience and then people who either came from the West Indies or came from Africa. And people who came from the West Indies and Africa do much, much, much better. And that really what happened was that African Americans picked up the redneck culture, which is that sort of honor culture. And if you look at what happens in a lot of African American communities, it is really that idea of respect, disrespect. You know, they have like a very sort of Genghis Khan attitude towards like acquiring as many females and as much cash, regardless of the circumstances in which it's acquired. And that's not a, his point is that that's not a question of being black. That's a question of, you know, this sort of redneck culture that they picked up. Because if you look at, you know, black people anywhere else in the world, without that culture, they do much, much better. But the two have fused in this very sort of potent and unfortunate way where, you know, a lot of people in those circumstances begin to think that the black culture is the culture of the ghetto. And so it ultimately becomes limiting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what to say. I grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, I went to the lab school. Where Obama sent his kids. It's the school's half black. The neighborhood's very multiracial. Farrakhan was 10 blocks from me.
Uh-huh. You
know, most of my friends were black. So I don't know. We just don't really agree on that.
Well, I mean, yeah. I think regardless, it's not to say that like you can read one book and necessarily figure out the whole story. And obviously everybody has an agenda, but
right.
I think that's the thing is that regardless, we have beliefs and we form beliefs, you know, based on our social context. And so we have to find ways to be able to talk about them so that, you know, whether those beliefs are beliefs about, you know, honor and respect or beliefs about whether the government is essentially good or bad or beliefs about whether, you know, I should rely on the police or not to defend me or whether I should rely on my ability to own a gun or our beliefs about when life begins. You know, I mean, it's very easy to close on these beliefs and inevitably all of us have those beliefs shaped by large historical forces that we can't possibly hope to see and understand.
Right.
And so, you know, I mean, I think that's the thing. We need the help of other people to help us understand the ways in which we are blind, as we're inevitably all going to be blind.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's a great James Baldwin quote, which goes something like, "People are trapped in history, and history is trapped in them."
Mm-hmm. That's totally true.
Yeah,
that's totally true.
That's for sure true.
But I think, yeah, I mean, I think part of what's so powerful about books like this, and I think probably a large part of the reason why whoever this person on Twitter was that recommended it, is because, you know, what this all really comes down to is a more realistic sense of how our minds actually work.
Right.
So that we can, you know, approach these conversations with a sense of humility and mutual respect.
Right. I agree with that. And that's why I tried to emphasize at the end, you know, there was, I forget which Malcolm Gladwell book it was, but one of them, you know, he's like, if we were just nicer to each other, you know, we could all, and he kind of tells this fairy tale. It may have been Blink, you know, and a lot of the arguments that I make in this book kind of explicitly contradicts some of the things he says in there. But the reason why I end the book where I end it, which is where I say, you know, we don't get to morally graduate from this.
Mm-mm.
You know, we are reductionists. We are stereotypers. Sometimes we don't call them that. You know, even positive stereotypes can be very detrimental to us. We don't call them stereotypes. But in any case, we're constantly simplifying, to your point. We're constantly using our mental constructs and kind of expanding them over the world. And we don't get to reach a time when that stops being true. You know, there's some like fairy tale about our moral evolution when we're not going to be biased against people. And it's not going to happen. And maybe in general, we can become, you know, more open and more empathetic to other cultures. And that may be happening, maybe not. But we don't get to, you know, we don't get to jump out of this and somehow become morally superior because this is so deeply tied to the way that we see the world and have to see the world in order to manage its complexity.
Well, and I mean, yeah, to your point, I mean, I think in terms of like just like Skinner, you know, over analogized in terms of thinking about the computer. I mean, I think we all sort of over analogized in terms of thinking about education, right?
Right.
There's this idea that at some point your education stops.
Right.
Which is, I mean, one of the more ludicrous ideas. But, you know, I mean, inevitably we sort of pick up that model. We're like, oh, you know, you go to school for, you know, 18 years, 22 years, 26 years, whatever it is. And then, you know, at a certain point, it's done. And then you just sort of like go and work.
Right.
But,
and habituation is part of that story.
You know?
I remember when I was like 18 or 19, it's like, why is everyone who's an adult just seem kind of like they're daydreaming or walking through life? Mm-hmm. And there are a few who get out of it. But part of that story is that the things that you get for free when you're younger, which is a sense of how unlikely this whole thing is worn away at. And because we just get used to everything. It's another element of our personalities, our capacities, which is adaptive, but also has this effect that life, if you're not careful, you don't work at it, can feel dull and repetitive and you can get stuck in a rut.
Well, and that's sort of, I mean, the real irony of all this sort of stuff. Like, we're happiest when we're constantly re-examining our mental models. Right.
Mm, I agree.
But at the same time, so many people are miserable and they don't understand why. Right.
Right. Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, like that's and I wrote a book and the girl that I wrote a book with or woman that I wrote a book with, Katie O'Brien, you know, she has a story that she loves to tell. And she was at the ballet and, you know, she was sitting next to this little girl and her father and the little girl's in, you know, a giant tutu and the whole thing and clearly just so excited. And her father leans over and is like, you know, you do realize this thing is going to be long. It's going to be 3 hours. You're not going to be bored, are you? And this little girl says, "Don't be silly, Daddy. Only boring people get bored."
Yes. That's fantastic.
But I mean, I think that's the thing, right? It's just that, you know, like, the world is endlessly fascinating. We've accumulated thousands of years of, you know, incredibly, you know, conflicted history full of, you know, things we should be proud of and things that are like really pretty tragic and unfortunate.
Right.
And, you know, you can literally spend your entire history looking at over that. There's like a huge amount of science in terms of trying to understand the intricacies of the human mind. Like, refining your mental models is something that you can be doing literally in for eternity.
Right. And it should be.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, as a good friend of mine said, he said, you know, thinking is just such a pleasure. You know, so I guess hopefully you want to find, the key is finding a job that lets you do that and lets you grow. And there are some like that, you know, like yours or filmmaking or where you learn a skill and you can apply it to different content matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that allows you to enter new worlds.
Well, but I think the interesting thing, right, is that increasingly we're all going to have jobs with it like that. And that's one of the big tensions is that, you know, I mean, the industrial age created, I mean, there's a quote from Woodrow Wilson back when he was, I can't remember if he was governor or president of Princeton at that point. But, you know, he goes and he speaks to this National Association of High School Teachers and he says, you know, what we need is an education system which can produce two classes of people. One class which has the benefits of a liberal arts education and, you know, is constantly questioning and, you know, this will be the managerial class. And then we need another, by necessity in any society, much larger group of people who will be so turned off and so like bored that they will never question anything and will do routinized, systemated, operational work. And, you know, I mean, I think that's the thing is that, you know, we look at our educational system and we're like, it's a failure. But it is a failure in a knowledge economy in the modern world. But it did exactly what industrial society or at least industrial elites wanted it to do.
That's an interesting point.
And so, you know, again, like it's that same idea of there's a model that develops in a particular time point and it's, you know, it's responsive to cultural and financial circumstances, but then, you know, persists longer than it should.
Right.
And you know, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you know, my parents live in the Middle East. I was born in Saudi Arabia, and so I spend a lot of time there. And there are a lot of things in the Middle East that made a whole lot of sense in the 6th century that don't necessarily make a total amount of sense now, particularly that sense of honor. You know, and I mean, again, like, I mean, that's part of Nisbet's point, is that a lot of this stuff is a double-edged sword, right? You know, I mean, if you look at the Arabs, they're incredibly courteous, they're incredibly hospitable, you know, and it's a similar thing with the South, but you've got to question, like, you know, what is the balance there? Is there a way that you can have politeness and courtesy and not have, you know, this sense of honor that leads you to murder people when they trespass?
right. Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's the funny thing is even, I mean, if you go back to, like, you know, what was it that sent Osama bin Laden off the rails? It was a sense of trespassing. You know, he felt that the Americans had trespassed on the Holy Land and, you know, that he needed to do whatever he could to get them.
Right. I mean, yeah. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens to, you know, what happens to these various cultures as the world gets smaller and communication lines are tighter and tighter. And, you know, it becomes harder and harder for cultures which depend upon being isolated to isolate themselves.
But at the same time, I mean, I think we're incredibly good at isolating ourselves, you know, and I mean, if you look at, I mean, you know, I don't think there's necessarily a straight line. I mean, if you look at what's happened in the U.S., right, communication technology has improved since the 60s. But in general, what has happened is that there's been a real sort of siloing of the two cultures. And I mean, obviously, there are many cultures, right? But at the broad level, red states versus blue states, they've increasingly just sort of retreated into their corners.
Right.
You know, they have their respective news sites and news media, you know, and then you go on Facebook and the majority of people don't understand that all they have is a model of the world. And, you know, they go and they Google around and it's like, oh, look, like I found a study that validates right. my worldview.
No, that's true. And in fact, there was a study which I don't mention in the book, which was about vaccine efficacy. Mm-hmm. And they took both positions, you know, for and against, and they showed them conflicting you know, write-ups online. And the conflicting information had a polarizing effect.
Yep.
And you know, and there's study after study after study that shows this, that uncertainty in some form tends to polarize people. It polarizes their trust judgments. It polarizes their political views. Hmm. It can even have a polarizing effect on their romantic judgments. Hmm. So moving us in general towards certainty. So I think you're absolutely right that those are the effects that it's had so far. And you could be right that that's the permanent effect. I'd be more interested to see, you know, what's the next generation? Do they come out like that too? I would suspect not, but I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't think there's any reason why we have to, but I think that that's part of the thing, right? Is that, you know, the world is changing faster than ever. And so, you know, we, again, like we have cultures that have evolved with a certain tolerance for uncertainty. And, you know, I think there are problems both way, right? In terms of, you know, an inappropriate lack of certainty, right? Which, you know, can happen in science, can also be excessively certain and dogmatic, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, by the same token, you find the same thing on, you know, sort of the more red state point of view, where, you know, they are incredibly certain on certain things. And then at the same time, they're like, nobody knows about global warming. Nobody knows about, like, you know, evolution. Like, evolution is still up for debate. Like, you know, these scientists don't know. Evolution is just a theory. So there's this real creative use in which both sides, you know, if you want to believe something, then, you know, it's a done deal. And if you don't want to believe something, then you like to pretend, oh, the jury is still out.
Right. I think it may be most dangerous when things are changing very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So one case study is, you know, George H.W. Bush mm-hmm. and German reunification.
Mm-hmm.
And he looked politically weak on that, but it was basically just waiting to see what the Russians were going to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he got his way. And, you know, Dick Cheney was against him on that. And so, you know, when in a circumstance when geopolitical factors are changing very quickly, the kind of flexibility that you should have is like, let's be cautious. Maybe the ground is shifting beneath us. That looks like timidity, but it's actually wisdom.
Well, it's the same thing as well with like John Kerry and flip-flopping and all that sort of stuff. Right. I mean, you know, it's kind of a ridiculous argument to have, you know, should you have a president who, you know, 100% always is decisive or who never makes up their mind? right? Like, right. Again, it's that idea that wisdom is knowing the difference. And I mean, you know, I mean, I think the other, like, in terms of history, sort of understanding the wisdom of George H.W. Bush, right? I think a lot of people, when Bush stopped 100 miles out of Baghdad, were like, you know, what is this guy? Like, the Bushes are tight with Saddam Hussein. They're friends. Like, that's why he didn't take him out, blah, blah, blah. They only care about the oil money. Well, you know, we got to, you know, run the other variant of that experiment in 2003. And it turns out that, you know, Saddam may have been a bad dude, but you probably wanted to leave him in place.
Right. No, I agree with you.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what's also so fascinating is that, you know, I mean, when you read this stuff about the Iraq War is that, you know, you had pretty much, I mean, the same exact people in the room, right? Like you had Colin Powell, you had, you know, Dick Cheney, you know, and you had a Bush, right? And presumably they talked to George H.W. Bush. And I think that H.W. Bush sort of, you know, backed the decision. I don't know the historical record on that, but the point is that it's very much the same people, and yet, you know, they get that decision wrong the second time, but it get right the first time.
Right. Well, it wasn't all the same people. And I think it was also, you know, 9/11 was such an acute event, mm-hmm. and the sense of threat was so palpable.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the points is that a lot of studies show that, you know, that's what a group wants in the face of an acute threat is certainty.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to be less willing to question it because, right. You know, it's almost like outsourcing, you know, it's like, oh, well, they know. I don't know, but they know. So I'll just say I trust them. So in a way, I'm escaping uncertainty just by, and that's, you know, that mirrors these studies on trust, that under uncertainty, the people you trust, the trust levels go way up, and the people you don't, trust levels go down.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, it's pretty fascinating. So can we talk through some of, because I mean, part of, you know, obviously, like, you know, there's all this great science and all this great insight in the book, but it's also just there are a lot of great stories.
Sure.
So, I mean, I particularly love the Ducati, the building a better Ducati story. So maybe you could talk us through that a little bit.
Right. The Ducati story was, so there's these two narratives, which you often see in business columns. You know, one is that failure is really great, and the other is, you know, about the dangers of success. And the Ducati story really shows both of those. They entered MotoGP racing, which is the, I want to say, 900cc engine class of motorcycle racing in 2003. They had a really bad season. Then in 2004, they had a great season, if I'm remembering this correctly. The point was, I mean, what it boils down to is, we tend to, when we do well, we don't really look for causes.
Mm-hmm.
We relax a little bit. We stop scrutinizing ourselves. And that can lead to, you know, you stop learning. But you basically, you drop out of learning mode. On the other hand, while you don't want failures, one thing that is good about them, even though the failure itself is not, is that it does force you to re-scrutinize yourself, scrutinize your assumptions. And just that, because of that motivation, if you take it the right way, you can go back and you can learn again and you can, you know, and you can progress. So the moral of the story is the same in both, is the point of the chapter, which is that, you know, Obama actually said this recently, right? If you do well, you know, don't take too much credit for it. And if you do badly, just get back to work. So in both cases, you know, you want to just stay in learning mode, and that becomes harder after successes.
Well, and that's, I mean, you know, I mean, we can all think of plenty of celebrities who haven't learned those lessons, right? Like I was actually talking to somebody about this the other day, but I studied, a year after high school and before college, I lived with Jim Watson of Watson and Crick.
Uh-huh.
And he's kind of, I mean, for me, he's pretty much the archetypal example of someone who really rested on his laurels. You know, I mean, he did this incredible thing at, you know, in his 20s, and then, you know, just sort of for the rest of his life really was like in, you know, reliving that sort of high school football glory days, and, you know, didn't get back to work. And, you know, Francis Crick really did get back to work. You know, he went on and he figured out a whole bunch of other things about transcription, And translation, and then, you know, proceeded to then, like, after he felt that, you know, the big questions in genetics had been answered, he went and started working in neuroscience. And so, you know, that he ends up being this very healthy Francis Crick, this very healthy man, whereas Jim sort of spends his time trying to say more and more and more sensational things. Ultimately, you know, by 50 years, he started saying, like, I mean, you know, he has never been very nice to Rosalind Franklin, and essentially attributes, you know, her, what he perceived as his, her problems, to being about her physical attractiveness. You know, and like, you know, I mean, ultimately he just sort of like went so far down that rabbit hole that, you know, one day he was being interviewed by somebody who I, from what I understand, he hadn't been particularly nice to. And she was a reporter, and he started mouthing off about, you know, how he didn't see very much hope for Africa because black people and IQ scores and, you know, just a bunch of stuff that was incredibly unscientific. And, you know, she published it. And after that, you know, they revoked his invitation to speak, you know, and he's sort of been fairly disgraced since then. But it is really that danger of, like, you have a success and you don't get back to work. And I mean, I think that's...
Right. And this gets into something which is at the end of the book, which is about to what degree, you know, one of the main messages of the book is that creativity is a spillover effect of cognitive dissonance, of some form of mental conflict. Now, it doesn't have to be, sometimes it can be a traumatic cognitive dissonance. You know, there's these books about that look at, you know, eminent personalities, and they take, you know, hundreds of eminent people, and they try to figure out what it was in their life that that led them to be so creative. With scientists and artists, there's a family of authors who did this, the Goetzel family. And one of the conclusions is this, was that they had early in their life, so they had kind of a certain, you know, they were all highly intelligent, but they had earlier in their life a propensity to go into isolation to do their work. So they had a habit form, you know, they had this habit early on of isolating themselves and having their, you know, this creative outlet, whether it was art or science. And one of the interesting things, which is not in the book, which is that, you know, there are two things I say. One, that creativity is an overflow of cognitive dissonance or any kind of mental conflict, but also that extremism is. So when does it result in extremism? When does it result in creativity? And one interesting hypothesis is that for people who get those energies out in a social way, that's where you see the ideological polarization. And for people who happen to be more socially introverted, they go home and they get those energies out in some kind of creative, you know, way, whatever it is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the thing. I mean, that's also, I think what's fascinating too, is that, like, you know, there's also been work, and I mean, obviously some of this does intersect, right? Although, you know, there is a sort of simplistic notion that conservatives are more closed-minded. But, you know, it is also that tension between conservatism and liberalism in terms of, you know, what does your mind close around, right?
Absolutely.
Because I think what's one of the things that I've sort of noticed that is, I think, a pretty fascinating pattern about conservatism is that there's always this tendency to go back to this sort of mythical imagined past. And, you know, inevitably, like, these people have moved on so much that they really have to imagine that past, right? So you have, you know, for example, you know, the Hasidic Jews are, it's a movement that's only a couple of hundred years old, right? So, you know, there's a group of guys in Eastern Europe, and they're like trying to return to the true roots of Judaism. But of course, it's informed by their context and, you know, where they are now. And, you know, they sort of lock around that. And so you have the fairly, you know, unusual sight of a bunch of guys in beaver hats walking around Los Angeles and, you know, these giant Eastern European coats. And you're like, are you not hot? But, you know, that's how they formed. Or, you know, you find the same thing in Islam, right? There's this idea of going back to the true original Islam, but, you know, it's being developed by guys who have only been around for 100 years. And so they come to these very fascinating notions. Like my dad was in, you know, my parents were in Libya, and there were a bunch of Salafis, Muslim fundamentalists, who were going and destroying a Sufi mosque, right? Because the Sufis tend to bury their dead within the mosques, and, you know, the Salafis think, oh, they're worshiping the dead, which is, you know, against Islam. And, you know, so an Arab friend of my parents is talking to this guy, and, you know, he's like trying to talk him down, trying to be reasonable with him, trying to get him to not destroy the mosque, do all these sorts of things. And, you know, the guy's like going and he's talking and he keeps on talking about Guantanamo. And, you know, he can't figure out what he's talking about. And he's like, why do you keep saying that word Guantanamo? And he goes, oh, that's the like place where they keep all of the, you know, Arab prisoners. That's where the Americans do all their terrible things. And he's like, don't you mean Guantanamo? And he goes, no. There was no G sound in the time of the Prophet.
Oh, wow. So he knew.
Yeah, he knew. He was like, no. You have to understand, like, we can't use the G sound. Because yeah. That is, you know, that is a Western corruption that has come into our culture.
Right. Well, the drive for purity, which takes form in many, expresses itself in many ways.
Yeah.
Is certainly, part of many kinds of extremism.
Well, and I think that's the thing. And I mean, you know, it's again, it's one of these things that we're all stuck with. Like, that's running around in our mind. And, you know, that desire for purity, you know, methodological purity, like, oh, you know, I don't like emotion and I don't like belief, so I'm going to create a model where humans are not emotional and don't have beliefs, right?
That's right. It was always the question that you wanted to ask those economists, like, if everyone is doing everything for a rational reason, what's your rational reason for proposing this hypothesis?
But like, it's
in your interest, right? According to you, right?
Well, but that's inevitably what happens. I mean, I think that's what's so fascinating is that, you know, like when you read The Wealth of Nations and you like look into the biography of Adam Smith, you know, Adam Smith's first book is The Moral Sentiments of Man. You know, this is what he was really interested in. He was interested in morality. He was interested in being a decent human being. And, you know, again, what has happened is that this real religion around pure greed has developed, which essentially relies on reading a single line of The Wealth of Nations, right? It is not from the generosity of the butcher or the baker or whatever it is that we expect him to be good, but purely from his own self-interest. And when you start to read other parts of The Wealth of Nations, you find that there are all these other fascinating things in there. Like, literally two paragraphs later, Smith has this whole thing about how, you know, because Smith was a tutor and he was an educator, so he was like, oh, you know, really, like, people are all basically equally smart. We just pick up different cultural environments. Like, up until about 5 or 6, nobody's really that different. But obviously, if you grow up in an environment where you're exposed to, you know, business, you learn business. And if you grow up in an environment where you're exposed to wheel making, you learn wheel making. And, you know, if you're exposed to this religion or that religion, you know, that's how you become acculturated. if you start from the idea that, hey, none of us are really that different, and, you know, all human beings have more or less equal capacity, then, you know, you reach entirely different conclusions than if you purely start from the idea that greed is the only thing that exists and greed is good. And, you know, you need to give up on your notions of equality or that. And I mean, one of the guys that we've had on here is David Sloan Wilson. And he studies altruism, right? There's a whole school of evolutionary science, you know, Dawkins and all those guys who deny that, like, there can be such a thing as altruism, right? Altruism is a myth. You know, like, yes, people may think they're being altruistic, but really they're doing it because they expect something in return.
Right.
And again, it's one of those things where, you know, these things have been, you know, it's the same thing that, you know, a Salafi Muslim will do, or, you know, any sort of fundamentalism. You pick a tiny piece of the text and then you extrapolate out from that. And so, but when you go back to the original text, you find that there are these other parts and that actually these people who are very smart had these sort of rounded worldviews.
Right.
And there's this great thing that's in the Origin of the Species where basically Darwin's point is that if you're within a group, your best strategy is to be selfish, but a selfless, altruistic, generous group is always going to outcompete a selfish one.
Oh, that's great. Right.
And that's true. And in fact, that's what, you know, when you do studies on this stuff, like they have this, Sloan Wilson's one of his graduate students did this amazing study that's all about water striders, those little things that float around on the top of the water.
Right.
And basically, it turns out that water striders come in two different flavors. There's a rapey one and a non-rapey one. And the what you find is that psychopathic water striders do really, really, really well. They're very good at propagating their genes.
Wow.
But groups that have lots of psychopathic water striders fall apart. They're disastrous. Because basically the female water striders get so traumatized that they can't even breed. And so what you find is that, yeah, you know, nice guys may finish last, but groups of nice guys finish first.
That's great.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's what's fascinating is, again, I mean, you know, you find that, like, we've all gone down these weird rabbit holes of thinking. And, you know, again, like, what, and that, I mean, I think why this, that's why this, your book so is so important, is because what it all comes down to is realizing that we're all basically cult members. You know,
right.
we can
that's
all
right.
basically become like weird fundamentalists and like come to these bizarre distorted conclusions. And the only strategy, the only hope that any of us have is to realize that about ourselves and then be able to be like, okay, like, I mean, you know, and we've had so many, I mean, that's sort of been the interesting journey about doing this podcast. Like, you know, we've had anarcho-capitalists on here, right? Huh. And, you know, they see the problems with government, and there are real problems with government, but then, you know, they dial down on that, and then they create this, you know, mythology that, like, the solution to all our problems is to have no government.
Right.
Which, you know, I mean, if you cherry pick your facts, you're going to come to that conclusion, but governments evolve for a reason. And if you look at what society was like before government, you find that there's band level genocide. Tribes would wipe each other out periodically.
Yeah. You know, removing the clan's ability to inflict punishment and, you know, endless cycles of violence and taking that punishment, you know, making that a function of the state and this ending cycles of violence, like, that worked.
Yeah, it worked really well. And I mean, that's part of the disaster of, you know, our invasion of Iraq, right, is that, you know, but George Bush Sr. understood, like, yes, dictators are horrible, horrible people, right, but they hold their countries together, right? That Leviathan is useful. And when you remove the Leviathan, all you do is get clan warfare.
Right. Well, this idea that you can just drop democracy into a place with weak state institutions is, I mean, I want to know, like, did you actually believe that? Did you really?
but that's what's fascinating is they really do. And I mean, it's what.
Right. And so how do you get to believe that? How do you have the view of the world, which has no reference to history,
mm-hmm.
you know, which has no reference to language.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is pretty close to this economic way of looking at the world.
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, it's basically the consequence of extreme individualism. Right. You dial down so much on individuals that you end up, you know, losing all sense of context and understanding that there are group identities. And you really have to look at what are those group identities. And you're like, oh, there are these two groups in this country and they hate each other.
Like, maybe that's going to affect things.
Yeah, exactly. And like, if there isn't some sort of wall between them, like, they're going to fucking kill each other. But I think that's the sort of the endlessly fascinating thing. And yeah, I mean, I really like encourage everybody. This was a great recommendation to read the book, because it is one of those books that does such a good job of, you know, giving you a proper sense of humility and perspective on who you are and how your mind works, so that, you know, you can start to be more realistic about how, you know, you're coming to believe the things that you believe, and then engage in that endlessly fascinating and enjoyable process of coming up with better and better models of the world.
That's so nice of you to say, Hunter. I really appreciate it. And I think you've hit on something that I was trying to accomplish. So that's heartening.
Well, you did. I mean, I think that's the great thing is that, yeah, I mean, you did. Congratulations. You know, go celebrate in whatever way that you feel is appropriate.
Yeah, right. I'm working, writing.
What are you working on now? What are you writing?
I'm writing a piece on the uses and limits of randomized control trials.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. That's awesome. And hopefully helping to, you know, correct the excesses of either rejecting science or slavishly worshiping any number.
Well, you know, it kind of gets back to what you said, which is that you want pluralism.
Yeah.
You want even methodological pluralism. And the reason why is that every belief system, or like any scientific tool, is going to steer you in a certain direction.
Mm-hmm.
And that's useful energy. You're going to find things by believing in one scientific tool or favoring one scientific tool or another. But other tools are going to look in other places. They're going to find other things. And there are going to be checks and balances at these, you know, so there's an ecosystem. So anyway, but yeah.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I think that's what's interesting as well, is because, part of the reason why Skinner and, you know, economics went down that weird rabbit hole is because fundamentally, like, the tools that we have to measure belief and emotion are not tools that appeal to the sort of tidy mathematical mind, right? It's like you have to talk to people. And
right.
They don't like that because sometimes people lie.
That's right. that's why there's been a lot of research on memorization, mm-hmm. and less research on conceptual learning. Now, which is easier to measure and which is more important?
Yeah.
Then you get it conflated. Then you get people who are like conflating the two.
Well, and you can reach these totally bizarre conclusions. Because, I mean, yeah, just to briefly wrap this whole thing up, I guess you're talking about Hermann Ebbinghaus.
There's some of that, right?
Yeah.
And there's a professor named Robert Bjork, who I interviewed for the book, but I didn't include. He does a lot of memory research, and it's good research, but it's not conceptual learning. And if you take those conclusions from those studies and apply them to conceptual learning, you get in a lot of trouble.
Well, and I mean, that's what I love is that the Ebbinghaus thing, is basically Ebbinghaus wanted to study the mind, you know, back in the 1800s. And I think it was 1800s. Was it 18 or 19?
The famous study is like 1878.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so essentially what happened was that, you know, he was like, oh, this is problematic. This is messy. How do I understand the box that is the mind? And so he was like, oh, okay, I know what I'm going to do. I recognize, and this is in terms of, you know, study design, which is the sort of thing that gets lost and people forget, right? He's like, I know that people are really good at remembering things that they have context for and that they're emotional about. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to remove context and create a bunch of nonsense words. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to remove emotion by saying everything in the most boring voice that I can. And so then he does that, and he demonstrates that, yes, you know, you can remember nonsense if you talk in a really boring way. The more repetitions you have, the more likely you are to remember it. But the problem is that that's sort of been the foundation of our educational system for a really long time. And everybody forgot that the whole point of the study design was to leave out the two much more powerful learning techniques, which are context and emotion.
That's right. So I'll give you an example. And this is why, you know, you have to interpret these studies very carefully. So there's Travis Prue, right, in the book, and he does a study where, you know, mental conflicts, having nonsense words on a computer screen or whatever, increases your pattern perception. And he has a study in which it shows that pattern perception goes up. It's like weird letter strings, and there are rules to the letter strings.
Mm-hmm.
And so he wanted to see, you know, two things. One, did people see more letter strings, you know, mm-hmm. identify them more letter strings as having patterns after experiencing essentially cognitive dissonance induced many ways? And two, did their accuracy go up? So he has a study where he shows, okay, yeah, people see more letter strings. That's because we're getting a little physical kind of jolt from the mental dissonance. And we're becoming a little more, you know, perception. We're trying to perceive patterns more. We become pattern hungry. And there's a little bump in accuracy. There's other studies which show that illusory pattern perception goes up, a whole string of studies. There's a great study which shows that, you know, compared parachute jumpers on an airplane looking at weird dots on a page, and they see, you know, more faces in it mm-hmm. than parachute jumpers on the ground, right? Because they're scared of, you know, their adrenaline is up.
Yeah.
So how do you write that story up? How do you write Travis's story up? If you want to, you can say confusion helps learning.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really accurate. So, and you know, if you follow that through, you know, if the kind of why it's simple learning. That's why it mm-hmm. works. It's simple learning. There's a long distinction in education between simple learning and complex learning. Now, if that was really about complex learning, which is what we really care about, mm-hmm. then a teacher who is throwing out random, you know, Chinese words during a lecture could increase students' understanding of Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some journalists who kind of did write it up that way.
Amazing.
So, you know, you got to be careful and you got to look exactly. This is something I'm more and more sensitive to as I, you know, learn more about this, about psychology and all the methodology, is you got to be really sensitive to what did they actually measure?
Mm-hmm.
How did they actually measure it? And a lot of the debates, you know, come from there. You know, you say you're measuring one thing, it kind of looks to me like you're measuring another. You put a little bit of spin on it in the paper you published, and a journalist amped up that spin, and now we have a conclusion that doesn't make any sense and that is actually harmful to educators who are trying to learn how to improve their classrooms.
But the one thing we do know is that people are purely rational. Right.
Of course they are.
Jamie, it has been a real joy. Ladies and gentlemen, as this conversation demonstrates to you, this is a man who, you know, really questions his own assumptions and is very thoughtful about what he puts down on the page, which is why his book, you know, is so, I mean, just a really, really, really great read. And again, the book is Nonsense, and I will include the link in the episode write-up.
Thanks a lot, Hunter. It was my pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure talking to you.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.